Welcome to Climate Radio and the second programme in our focus on the Arctic. Last month we explored how the observed rate of change in the polar north is surprising scientists into revising their projections for the speed at which global warming will unfold, unless we take urgent action. But if the Arctic is where scientists see warning signs and a wake-up call, oil companies and their friends in government see only economic opportunity. So this month we take a look at where some of the battle lines lie in the fight to stop the Arctic being drilled for oil and gas, and how concerned citizens can get involved and help win the war. After a lengthy inquiry during the course of 2012 involving the gathering of testimony from many expert witnesses, last September a cross-party parliamentary committee of MPs in the UK called for a moratorium on drilling in the Arctic, concerned about the potential impacts on climate change and concerned about the lax safety regime surrounding this high-risk activity. In January this year, the UK government responded to the committee's report by rejecting its key recommendations and using old science to suggest that Arctic drilling could be compatible with avoiding dangerous climate change. It seems like the government is misleading MPs when it says that it fully supports the use of the highest environmental and drilling standards in the Arctic, as a Freedom of Information Act request discovered that they have been lobbying against EU legislation designed to make Arctic drilling safer. So we thought we'd ask the chair of the Environment Audit Committee, Joan Worley MP, what she thought of the government's response to her committee's report and recommendations. So firstly, how would you characterise generally the government's response to your report?
We've produced our reports for the Environmental Audit Select Committee Protecting the Arctic, and we did it because we wanted to flag up the very complex issues that are involved in making sure that this pristine area is treasured really by everybody individually and collaboratively. And I think that the government response to some extent acknowledges the importance of everything being done to protect the Arctic, but I think when you actually look at the detail of what needs to be done, then the government's response could have gone an awful lot further than it actually did. I think the key things for us in our report were, first of all, we just asked how consistent it is for government to, if you like, support further drilling in the Arctic, and how that is going to be consistent with restricting world temperature rises to 2 degrees centigrade. That was one of the areas that we wanted government to respond to. We also called for a sanctuary, and we also called for a moratorium on drilling. And I think clearly the government is treading very carefully. It wants to see as much protection for the Arctic, but it's not really accepting our individual recommendations.
Right. So, yeah, like you say, you concluded that there was some a discontinuity in the government's thinking, really, about how it's supporting Arctic drilling on the one hand and also wants to keep global temperature rise to a maximum of 2 degrees C. Do you think they've shown adequately in their response that the two are compatible?
Interestingly, we had a debate in Parliament on our report where the government minister had an opportunity to respond, and this whole issue about how consistent it is to allow more drilling consistent with keeping the halt on the temperature rise, that was raised. And I think it's a question of the government really looking much more closely at the 2012 data of the World Energy Review. And I think that it's not easy for anybody to find a way of squaring a circle which talks about the importance of energy supply, the importance of access to energy, and the importance of making sure that we don't add to the amount of carbon that is already there, and transferring over to zero carbon. So obviously there needs to be a transitional plan in place, but we believe, especially in the light of Nicola Stern's further concerns expressed in Davos just in January, that all the indicators are that we're on track for more than 2 degrees centigrade rise. So governments have to really start to address this.
I also interviewed Tim Lenton and Peter Wadhams last week, and one of the conclusions really of that was very much in the same way as your report concluded, although there's even new observations coming in all the time, that you know scientists are very surprised by what's happening on the ground and that the models are struggling to catch up. Do you think the government should be much more led by you know some of the very latest data that we're seeing now?
I think that there is an issue about the modelling that is being used, and I think it's the question of the rate of ice melt and the volume of ice as well. And it might just be that the modelling that's been used in the past isn't any longer fit for purpose. And I think the question then is how quickly can the research adapt to that, and then what funding is there for that research, and how is all that information collated so that we've got evidence-based policy. And I think that one of the recommendations that was important to our committee when we carried out our inquiry is that we realise that this is a fast-moving situation, and that events over the last few months with the rate of ice melt and concerns about black carbon as well could lead to perhaps need for different kinds of modelling. So we shall certainly in the months ahead, as well as connecting with the Met Office to see what work they're doing on this, be wanting to see how government is getting the best possible scientific evidence to really paint a true picture based on current trends, so that future modelling reflects that rather than an out-of-date set of data.
And so you also said that you've recommended a sanctuary. Would that mean that some areas would be permanently off limits for drilling?
Well, that was why we wanted to go ahead with that recommendation. And obviously we recognise that that's not something that is something that the UK government can do. But what we want to do is to make sure that the diplomacy and the talks which are ongoing between government, between Foreign and Commonwealth Office, together with the Arctic Council and the states concerned, that we're using the expertise that we have in this country to inform wider debate as a basis for policy making.
You also, you've recommended that the government support a moratorium. Perhaps you can speak a bit more about the leverage that the government does have over multinational companies or drilling plans, bearing in mind it's not one of the countries with a direct legislative interest in the, you know, that geographical location, unlike other members of the Arctic Council.
Well, for us, we took lots of evidence, and one of the questions that we wanted to ask was whether or not we felt that there were safeguards in place and the contingency plans in place in the event of any oil spill. And what really was hammered home to us is that the circumstances in the Arctic are really very different from in many other places. And given that the technology hasn't really caught up with the particular circumstances in which drilling would take place in a very, very difficult climate, we didn't feel that the safeguards were in place. And on that basis, we felt that until that had been addressed, there should be a moratorium. And one of the other issues that we looked at very closely, given the evidence that we received, was this whole issue about liability for clean-up costs and the importance of anybody who would be looking to exploit oil and drill, making sure that they had the ability to pay in full for any clean-up costs. That obviously is an issue, and one which we shall want to keep a close watch on.
Companies like BP and Shell are presumably listed on the UK stock market and registered corporations in the UK. I mean, there must be some legislative leverage that the UK has there, potentially.
Well, I think that this comes back to, well, whose responsibility is it? Because although we might be talking about companies registered here, we're not talking about their operations in a place where we have jurisdiction. So obviously that there are difficult issues to understand and to look at, but I would have thought that investors looking to invest in different companies would want to, if you like, pay close attention to our report, and they would want to perhaps ask the kind of questions that we're asking. So this isn't just a matter for government and for any leverage that government can apply here to British companies. I think it's really about a whole approach towards how we protect the Arctic and how we do that consistent with the constraints that there are in terms of carbon production. And I just feel that this is an issue whereby our report can hopefully help to raise these questions with other people who have got decision-making responsibilities of one kind or another, including investors.
I mean, is a safe clean-up ever possible? I mean, in the Gulf of Mexico, we saw huge impacts that are ongoing. They threw a bunch of dispersant at it, which disappeared the oil from sight, but obviously it's still there in the kind of ecology of the region and impacting on the food chain and people's livelihoods. I mean, is there actually any way you can deal with millions of barrels of oil just spilling into an ocean?
Well, clearly, as you've just referred to, other examples and other incidents have got enormous long-term costs, not least to the environment. And what we're talking about now in respect to the Arctic is drilling in a pristine area where we're not sure that the technology and everything else that would be needed to deal with any oil spill is actually there and has been tested. So that is just a huge risk to take, and that was why we felt that there should be a moratorium until all these questions about safe dispersal and clean-up had actually been answered.
Finally then, the day that the government's response to your report was published, The Guardian also published details of some leak showing that our government had been arguing within the EU to water down legislation that would protect the Arctic from risky drilling. Do you get the feeling that the government is saying one thing to you in public and doing something else in private?
Well, I think that's exactly why it's so important that we have the European Union with its application for Arctic Council status going ahead, and that we have absolute transparency about what position the European Union will be taking in respect of different aspects and our own UK government's contribution to that position. And certainly we do need to have transparency. I think with the difficulty with it is that it's not anybody's direct responsibility, so it's about really how you can get leadership.
Yeah.
And I think, in a way, in all of this, I think that the general public have a great part to play. But, you know, they don't want to see the Arctic despoiled, and so that has to translate somehow into direct policies. And I think it is the role of the Select Committee of the House of Commons to try and, if you like, start this debate and try and get these issues onto the political agenda so that a report of the complexity that we have produced, with as much evidence as we have taken and with our recommendations, can be the basis for holding government to account for the way in which it is going ahead protecting the Arctic. And as you just said, you know, if you have the European Union looking at, you know, at one position and the government trying to water that down, that's something that the British public needs to know about.
That was Joan Worley MP, Chair of the UK Parliament's Environmental Audit Committee. This month, Greenpeace UK gave evidence to the committee's inquiry into protecting the Arctic, which is now entering a new phase, focusing on the government's response and Shell's poor safety record in the Arctic during 2012. I spoke to Charlie Cronick, Senior Government Advisor at Greenpeace, who works on the Arctic, for his take on the UK government's response.
The first question I wanted to deal with was this 2 degrees C question, which, you know, they backed up their assertion with this data from the International Energy Association from 2011.
Yeah.
And they're saying that, therefore, using that data, it's all Arctic drilling is compatible with 2 degrees C.
Yeah, it's very hard to see how they reached those conclusions, frankly. I mean, first of all, they didn't use the most current version of the World Energy Outlook, which is kind of it's the gold standard for kind of global energy stats. And what was absolutely clear from the 2012 edition is, first of all, that if you were going to be even roughly within the 450 scenario, which only gives you a 50-50 chance of staying below 2 degrees, mind you, not, it's not anything like a guarantee, that there will be both adequate supply in global oil supply before you got anywhere near the Arctic for that scenario for 2030, you know, going all the way out to 2035. And in fact, the World Energy Outlook explicitly said that they saw little or no role for Arctic production in meeting oil demand in the period up to 2035. So it's very difficult to see how the government could have actually read the report and drawn that conclusion.
Yeah. Do you think there's also a thing going on where everybody's using, you know, kind of cherry-picking science? I mean, IPCC science, you know, which the International Energy Association will be basing its scenarios on, is kind of old and also being shown to be conservative when you look at what's actually happening in you know, through current observations in a changing Arctic today.
Yeah, I think they are definitely, I mean, A, they're not using the most current figures. B, it is selectively looking. I mean, what they did specifically in their response to the committee's suggestion moratorium was they said that depletion, you know, depletion in existing oil fields would mean you'd have to drill for more oil, you know, which is probably true, except for the fact that there has been an overwhelming surge in oil supply. You know, and Greenpeace is not endorsing this, but I mean, everything from the Canadian tar sands to, you know, light tide oil in North America, increase in Brazilian production, you know, projected in the next between now and 2020. I mean, there's an absolute glut of oil in the world, either from already discovered, though not yet developed, resources, and the Arctic resources aren't even discovered yet. So the idea that, you know, that there's an inevitability about drilling in the Arctic is, you know, it's pure political convenience.
Mm. I mean, we are looking at these kind of more extreme sources of energy these days.
Yeah.
And there's this quite famous now carbon bubble report, which
yeah.
is saying basically, you know, a fifth of all the fossil fuel companies' reserves are burnable if we want to stay within that 450 parts per million scenario again.
Yeah.
And that's like saying four-fifths of what oil companies hold in their reserves is unburnable.
Well, it's not actually, that's not strictly true. It's not just,
okay.
It's not just oil companies. That includes coal. And you have to...
Right.
Coal is the most carbon-intense fuel, and gas is also part of what oil companies hold, and that's probably the least carbon intense of the fossil fuels. So
right.
you can't take the overall figure
right.
From the carbon bubble report and apply it sort of as take it straight across to oil companies.
Right.
But if you do look at what the World Energy Outlook has done and looks at, you know, sort of projected demand scenarios and then what the potential for the temperature increase is linked to that demand scenario, then it's really terrifying, because basically the current policy scenario, which is more or less the version that of business as usual that's presented by the World Energy Outlook, if that carried on between now and 2035, you'd end up with a six degree average global temperature increase, probably be greater in the Arctic. If you looked at, for example, the Harvard, the Belfer Institute projections for increased production and demand related to that, you'd be, you know, 8-9 degrees. I mean, it's off the charts, and that's what's really important. If you, it's the relevance of the demand for a particular product to an overall energy economy, and the real situation is we've got way more oil than we can burn, not anything like a shortage.
So really, we should be kind of looking at the reserves and saying we should be discriminating amongst them and saying what's the most risky here, and maybe we should be keeping away from it.
Absolutely, I mean, that's for sure, that we should be staying away from, you know, the ones that have the biggest, you know, the biggest risk and the highest cost, because there, besides the fact that it drives, you know, that it keeps energy prices high, which environmentalists in the past have sort of tended to like, the problem is that if you invest in the most expensive and risky extraction, you've got that much less money to invest into reducing demand and to cleaner supply down the road, and that's the other really big problem with things like the tar sands and Canadian tar sands in the Arctic reserves, is it locks you into a high carbon future. So not only is it chasing the wrong objective, it's spending precious resources, locking you into an outcome that you don't want.
Do we know what kind of size the Arctic oil and gas reserves are estimated to be?
Well, the estimate is from the estimate that everybody uses is the U.S. Geological Survey from 2008. And they say about 90 billion barrels of oil, which is, I mean, is only, if you could get all of it, is only about 3 years' supply of oil, which is the irony of all this, at current levels of consumption. So, I mean, it's there is something ironic that people are getting them, they're, you know, so tied up in knots and spending such vast quantities of money for a relatively small and extremely challenging resource to get at.
Do we know, have any idea what that would translate into in terms of if all that was burnt and temperature rise?
Well, the temperature rise, it goes back to the conversation we were having just a little bit earlier, which is the temperature rise will be all about the level of demand. If you had a level of oil demand that was consistent with that level of supply, you know, sort of on the current policies or even bigger, it would the increase would be anywhere from 6 degrees and up. So, you know, the 450 scenario, you wouldn't get anywhere near Arctic oil, and you'd still only have a 50% chance of staying beneath 2 degrees.
Okay. What about this the other key recommendation that came out of the Environment Audit Committee's report was that there should be a moratorium on the Arctic drilling, and they said until, and they gave a lot of kind of caveats, you know, a list of recommendations about what should be in place to make the situation safe before Arctic drilling resumes. The government seemed to just kind of dismiss that and say basically there are efforts going on to make things safer, you know, we think that's enough, we don't really want to add our voice to the calls for a moratorium. Do you think that's the right approach?
Well, I mean, not surprisingly, Greenpeace doesn't think there's any way you can make drilling in the Arctic safe. And I think you really, realistically, you only have to look at the experience that Shell has had. Shell has had this summer. You know, they've spent nearly $5 billion over the last 4 or 5 years. You know, they've brought rigs and gear from all around the world. They, you know, their rigs were catching fire before they even left the harbor, never mind the offshore Arctic. I don't think there is any credible way that you can press ahead with Arctic drilling under the sort of current circumstances. And their record is pretty much all you need to in terms of evidence. But don't just take our word for it. Total said that they didn't think drilling for oil could be safe in the Arctic. BP, who are not known for their fantastic safety record, have suspended their Liberty project in offshore project in the Chukchi. I mean, there are just tons of examples. Credit Agricole, one of the, you know, the analysts on the supply side, have said they don't see Arctic returns happening anytime soon. Bernstein's another famous, you know, another big analyst in the oil world, say that they're bound to be, returns from the Arctic are bound to be slow and disappointing. It's just the government and, you know, not surprising, the oil companies seem to be the only people who think that it's a good idea.
Mm. And another couple of examples come to mind. Lloyd's insurers.
Yep. Lloyd's, I mean, to be fair, Lloyd's said that they thought it was a very, very high-risk proposition, but that, you know, on balance, it was difficult to see where the benefits were gonna land. Mm-hmm. They were possibly a little more positive than some of the other people, or at least kept a more open mind.
I mean, the IEA themselves have said something in the latest report, haven't they, about nothing significant coming from the Arctic.
Well, that's typically whether you should or not. I mean, and whereas I think that the IEA has been very clear that they don't think between now and 2035 there's going to be a significant contribution from the Arctic. I would definitely agree with that. But we don't think there should be anything in the, you know, beyond then either.
Yeah. I mean, in their response, the government seemed to be saying, well, yes, there are risks and we recognise them, and standards aren't, you know, the highest that they could be at the moment. Nevertheless, we should still be going ahead. I mean, that's a contradictory kind of statement, isn't it? I mean,
it's completely contradictory, and you only have to look at the role that the UK has played in kind of pressing the imposition of the strictest drilling standards to apply to EU companies, operating outside of EU waters. The UK really opposed that. And frankly, it's hard to see why you would do that if you say you actually believe in the highest standards being applied all around the world.
Yeah, this was the story about the British government working behind the scenes, kind of secretively. I think it came out through a leaked document.
Yeah, so it came out through an FOI document, a Freedom of Information request. Yeah.
that actually kind of trying to water down EU legislation to make it that would have made it safer. How trustworthy are any of the government statements about their intentions, do you think?
Well, I think what's really should give people pause for thought is that on the one hand there is an overwhelming sort of body of both evidence and opinion that says this just isn't, whether from an economic, environmental or energy security point of view, this isn't worth the risk. At the same, if you really did go on the evidence-based decision making, it would be a no-brainer. You wouldn't do it. But there is a real, really genuinely, seemingly unbreakable relationship between the interests of government and the interests of sort of key companies like BP, like Shell. You only have to look at the deal didn't go through, but the original BP Rosneft deal from winter 2011, I believe it was, when the then Secretary of State went over and stood in front of the Union Jack while they signed their agreement. In the end, the agreement didn't go through because the incompetence of the business deal. But the incredibly close relationship between UK government and oil companies is. It does really cloud the sort of the decision making, as far as we can tell.
I mean, so for example, I did try and get a spokesman from DEC, the Department for Energy and Climate Change, to respond to some of these questions, and they said, well, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office is leading on it, which seems to imply that the Foreign Office is kind of, like you say, probably closer with the companies and probably more led by their interests than the concerns of climate change.
Well, that's almost certainly true, but I think what would be fair to say is that there is a history, going right back to the founding of BP, Anglo-Iranian oil company in the early part of the 20th century. The interests of government, certainly in terms of foreign affairs and the energy industry, are seen to be inextricably and very closely linked. And I think realistically, if we're ever going to get serious about climate change, that link's going to have to be broken, and there's going to have to be a willingness to consider some other interests.
The Environment Audit Committee seemed to be suggesting that maybe we should bash some heads together so that DEC, the Department for Energy and Climate Change, and the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, kind of met and talked about these issues and tried to get a common perspective, so they weren't kind of so maybe climate change would and having a livable future on this planet might get a kind of say.
Well, I mean, that would be fantastic, but why limit it to those two? I mean, I think it would be sensible to bring in business and treasury as well. I mean, you only have to... The UK economy, everybody worries about how overly dependent we are on financial services. We're really overly dependent on fossil fuels. BP and Shell are the biggest providers, in terms of cash, of dividends in the UK equity market. Every pension fund in the country is hugely invested in those countries. And the reality is, in the future, fossil fuels are not going to, and this goes a bit back to that carbon bubble discussion, fossil fuels aren't going to be an asset, they're going to be a liability. And there's going to be a huge dent in both the dividends and the market capitalization of those companies. That is an enormous, even without thinking about what climate change is going to do to the UK economy, eventually, the value of those assets are going to be, recognized not as a value, but as a liability. And at that point, unless the UK started to move away from the incredible overdependence we have on those assets, we're going to be in deep trouble, financially as well as environmentally. And I think that's the that is another huge lesson from this. That if we're serious about a sustainable future, not just in environmental terms but in economic terms, we're going to have to move away from those few companies that the only thing they do essentially is dig things up and then sell them for other people to burn.
Hmm. Okay, imagine for a moment that we had a government that was genuinely committed to avoiding dangerous climate change and making, drilling safe, if that was at all possible in the Arctic. Mm. What kind of steps would we see that kind of government taking?
Well, the first thing is you wouldn't have to drill in the Arctic ever if you were committed to avoiding a 2-degree, greater than 2-degree future. I mean, there's no need to make drilling safe, because what you would do is you would reduce the level of consumption at home to where the efficiency actually overtakes the sort of the consumption. You're not chasing supply anymore, you're chasing energy efficiency. Secondly, even though there isn't much of a domestic car industry in the UK anymore, you would push for the companies that are heavily invested here, and that's everything from companies like Nissan to Indian-owned companies like Range Rover, Jaguar Land Rover, German companies, BMW, to say if you really want to stay in business as a car company, what you have to do is move away from dependence on imported fuels and think about ways that you can that you can be an advocate for a different kind of energy future. Those would be the kind at the same time as decarbonizing your power sector. I mean, there are a million and one prescriptions out there for how you reduce carbon emissions, but also kind of future-proof your energy and transport systems. And at the moment, the UK government is doing absolutely nothing to address any of those agendas. And in fact, what they're doing is pressing for an expansion of a ongoing fossil fuel agenda.
But in terms of the Arctic and Arctic drilling, we could be saying, we have some influence, considerable influence with the EU and with the US. We could be advocating for the Arctic to be put off limits and some of these
absolutely.
Other...
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the recommendations of the Arctic Committee were bang on. A moratorium on oil and gas exploration in the Arctic is absolutely the right thing to do. And as we've discussed, there is absolutely no way that if you were serious about addressing climate change and having a shot at staying underneath 2 degrees, that you would ever be drilling in the Arctic. It just wouldn't make any sense at all.
Okay. Could the government also regulate against companies that are listed here on the stock markets or registered in the UK?
It depends on what you mean. In terms of, you could. I think the kind of stuff that Carbon Tracker has been talking about, where you do actually have to acknowledge your fossil fuel holdings as liabilities as opposed to assets, would be that would present some real challenges to the market capitalization of fossil fuel companies. I think, in terms of making decisions about whether or not it's legitimate to explore for oil and gas in other sovereign territories, no. Frankly, I don't think the UK government couldn't ban it, but they could send a very strong signal that they favor a moratorium on drilling, at the same time as supporting the kind of measures that would mean you'd never get to the level of demand that would make it even remotely economically attractive. Because in the end, it's got to pay. And Arctic oil at the moment is likely to be amongst the most expensive, even under current levels of demand. Never mind future reduced levels of demand. It's one of the most current expensive supplies going. So it'd be pretty. It's very hard to imagine if you had a government that was serious about reducing consumption and therefore reducing emissions that it would ever get in the frame.
What about lending to oil companies that are undertaking risky drilling? I mean, we own 84% of the Royal Bank of Scotland.
Sure.
So, surely we could be saying we shouldn't be lending our money to this.
Absolutely. At the same time, we shouldn't be providing export credit guarantees to companies like BP who are drilling for very deep, high-pressure wells off Brazil and any number of risky propositions. There are policy levers that will take the right out of the deal, everything from, really examining export credit guarantees, things, as you said, where, at least with the state-owned banks or, having a clear climate change policy that is in place and is actually adhered to. There are plenty of opportunities. But the first thing, the easiest thing they could do, never mind actually enforcing the rules that already exist, would be to accept that the recommendations of the committee are worth pursuing and then finding out how to implement them.
Okay, finally, just throw this in. Do you have any ideas about how people can get this up the government's agenda? And other than kind of, I know you've got a global petition to get Obama to withdraw Shell's license and make the Arctic a kind of sanctuary.
Yeah, and that is, that's a longer-term proposition. I think in the shorter term, what's really clear is that the Environmental Audit Committee inquiry, which has been running for well over a year now, thanks to the ongoing sort of saga of Shell's messing, or catastrophes in the Arctic, have done an amazing job of pushing up the political agenda. But for them to carry that on, politicians need to hear from individuals that they actually care about this stuff. So you know, it sounds a bit cliched or even trite, but letters to MPs and other, you know, representatives saying this is really important and we really want you to pursue it would be the kind of thing that would allow politicians to put forward, say, an early day motion calling upon the government to support a moratorium. You know, just keeping it on the political, you know, they won't be able to do it without some support. It doesn't take a huge amount. You know, you don't need a, you know, a march like, you know, the Iraq War, but it just letters and emails to MPs will remind people that this is a genuine issue that people really care about.
That was Charlie Cronick, senior advisor at Greenpeace UK. We did, by the way, ask to interview someone from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, but were told that no one was available. If we receive a reply to our written questions, we will post them on the Climate Radio website at climateradio.org. Next up, here's James Marriott, co-founder of the Oil Industry Watchdog platform, with his story of how Shell's Arctic drilling rig, the Kulluk, started the year on the rocks off the coast of Alaska.
There's this drilling rig which is 28,000 tons of machine. It's a very, very big monster of a thing, and it has no propulsion of its own. So they needed to move it from this place called Dutch Harbor in the Aleutian Islands across the Gulf of Alaska to the port of Seattle, where it was going to be repaired and refitted this summer's drilling season in the Arctic. They tried to use it last summer and pretty unsuccessful, and they wanted to use it again. They pulled it out of Dutch Harbor, and within a short space of time, the tug had engine problems, so they had to bring another tug along and try and replace that one, and then kept on dragging it. After 10 days, they hit this disaster. The reason why they hit the disaster is they were essentially dragging it across the Gulf of Alaska. In the darkest period of the year, they left on the winter solstice while the rest of us were celebrating, and through effectively hurricane conditions. And it broke its moorings and was washed and battered onto the shore of an island just south of Kodiak Island, and it took them a week to drag it from there to the safety of another harbour. In the process of that happening, about 500 emergency personnel were involved from the state of Alaska. The jury is slightly out on this, but the evidence seems to be that the reason why the company Shell chose to drag this rig from there was to avoid a very large tax bill, which might have been lobbied on them by the state of Alaska if it had remained in Alaska. And by using a little loophole, they avoided that tax bill and decided to try and drag it to Seattle to avoid it. It's an irony then that the state coffers had to pay to get the damn thing off the rocks, 500 personnel involved and many, many emergency staff involved to get this thing off the rocks. So then on one hand you've got the company tax dodging, and on the other hand you've got the state having to help it out with the money that they would normally spend on other things for public services, even in America. It's the most recent in a long litany of problems that the company's had, stretching really from spring last year, 2012. In the spring of last year, on April 16th, the head of Shell and the head of investor relations from Shell gave a presentation here in the City of London to investors on a number of issues. And right at the end, they chose to include a couple of slides about the Arctic. And they made very, very light of it, like it was all going ahead smoothly and swimmingly and there wasn't really going to be much of a problem. It wasn't really much of an issue. And in fact, many, as far as we understand, many investors didn't raise any issues around it. At the time, it was considered to be an inevitability that the drilling in the Arctic was going to happen. The question is whether it was going to happen with a small impact or a large impact, but it was going to happen. A year on, we now realize that inevitability is shifting, and certainly the wider public, and we hope the investors, will begin to ask the question on whether really it is inevitable that drilling takes place in the Arctic. We argued at the time that the only inevitable thing that came from drilling in the Arctic is that it was inevitable that there would be an environmental disaster. There's a good likelihood that if they start the process now, it may be a century before they're finished. A very long time span. Of course, all this is fairly speculative. It depends how much they find and so on and so forth. But if we look at any other oil provinces in the world, they go through very long time cycles. And the idea that there wouldn't be an environmental disaster at some point during that whole cycle is just crazy.
If a spill is inevitable in the case that Arctic drilling eventually goes ahead, what kind of impact would that have on people who invest in a company like Shell, including ordinary pension holders? I spoke to Louise Roos from Fair Pensions about the increasing risks posed by fossil fuel investments.
The major risk that Arctic drilling brings with it for people who've got money invested in Shell is the risk of a significant oil spill and the lack of certainty around how Shell would be able to deal with that. If there was a significant oil spill in the Alaskan Arctic, it's very likely that that would have significant financial implications for the company. And the nearest comparison we have is what happened to BP, another UK giant, when there was an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, where it had to cancel its dividends, where its shares dropped dramatically in value. And so if you have shares in Shell, you need to be worried about whether the company is in a position to deal with an oil spill or whether it too would face significant financial loss.
Yeah. Are you able to put any figures on the BP impact? Just how badly did it hit BP?
Well, prior to Deepwater, BP was responsible for paying £1 in every seven of dividends that a UK company paid, and that disappeared overnight. The shares dropped by over a third. Its current total tally for the spill stands at over $40 billion.
What does that mean to an investor?
Well, first of all, when dividends are cancelled, that's the income that a company pays out to its shareholders. It's the check you get each quarter. And that suddenly was stopped, which meant if you held shares in BP, you suddenly were getting no dividends. It also meant that any pension fund that was invested in BP stopped receiving income from BP until the dividend recommenced. In terms of the share value falling, it meant that really there was no possibility of you selling your shares because you were likely to lose money, and so you had to hold on to the shares. And the value still hasn't increased to its pre-spill amount. So many investors, depending on when they bought the shares, are sitting on a potential loss if they were to sell, and the income that they received on an annual basis has dropped substantially.
So the impacts are substantial and significant.
Yes. BP obviously suffered an incident which was the largest oil spill in US history. It brought with it a lot of lawsuits and regulatory fines, and so the impact was extremely severe. It's not as simple as saying Shell would suffer exactly the same trouble if they were to have a spill, but it does serve as a warning to ensuring that there's adequate capability to deal with a spill, or that is the potential situation people could find themselves in.
And some people have been saying that it would be much worse, much more difficult to clean up a spill, and the impact's possibly greater, potentially on the kind of fragile ecosystems and the people living around the area. What do we know about Shell's potential response plans?
The point you raised about the ability to deal with a spill in the Arctic is really the key issue. There's two major issues with regard to the Alaskan Arctic. The first is remoteness. So where are they operating? Where Shell proposes to drill for oil in the Alaskan Arctic is 1,000 miles away from the nearest Coast Guard air station. So if you think about it in practical terms, if there was a spill, how long will it take to get the relevant people to the area? How many people can you get there? And how much equipment can you bring with you? The Gulf of Mexico oil spill happened in an area very close to a number of airports, very close to the coast in relative terms. And so the response capability was quite significant. The Arctic is very, very remote. The second issue is, of course, the Arctic has ice cover for quite a large part of the year. And we have concerns around the efficacy of Shell's spill equipment in the case of ice in the water, which is highly likely, as it has not been tested in ice. And secondly, as the ice moves in, as summer fades in the Arctic, the ability to move ships and equipment in the Arctic obviously reduces. And so if a spill were to occur very close to the end of the summer, what would be your time frame? What would be the amount of time available to you to actually respond to the spill? Again, think back to Deepwater. It took several months for BP to develop the technology they needed to stop the spill. we wouldn't have that luxury of time were a spill to occur late in the drilling season as ice began to move in. So the consequences for the environment and the implications for financial fines could be very significant in the case of a spill such as that.
Do you think investors are sufficiently aware of the risks of Arctic drilling, or are they accepting Shell's assurances at face value?
I think that the incident on New Year's Eve where the Kullock rig ran aground served as something of a wake-up call for the investors' community. I think during the summer there was a number of setbacks that Shell experienced, failure of safety equipment and final testing, failure to meet emissions targets and so on, that kind of went unnoticed by investors, perhaps seen as blips. I think investors have been rushing to catch up with Shell and the Arctic. There's been a number of other issues in the oil and gas industry where they've been focusing their attention. The Kullock incident, wake-up call, it's led to the US government reviewing the Arctic program in its entirety. And I think there needs to be a push by investors for more research from both the company itself and the company perhaps funding, or the US government funding, independent research studies on issues like how quickly would it take to respond to an oil spill, what effect would ice cover have on a spill late in the drilling season, and so on. In terms of the difficulties that they've experienced over the summer, there really was, you know, one almost on a monthly basis where they admitted they weren't going to be able to meet the emissions targets that have been set, and they requested permission to go beyond those targets. Their safety equipment failed its final test. It was reported that it crushed like a beer can when it was tested in the ocean. Their ships, the Arctic Challenger, which is the ship which would carry the safety equipment, was cited by the Coast Guard as not being fit for the sea. The Noble Discoverer, another one of its ships, slipped its anchor in Anchorage when it tried to get out of the harbour. We then ultimately came to a situation where they had to abandon their drilling program for oil because they couldn't get their ship, the Arctic Challenger, certified in time. And so Shell were denied permission this year by the Coast Guard to drill for oil, and instead could only do top hole drilling, so they couldn't actually drill down for oil because their safety ship wasn't ready. They then were only 36 hours drilling when, because of approaching ice, they had to abandon drilling. And then on the way back to Seattle at the end of drilling season, the Kullock ran aground on New Year's Eve, which is one of their drilling ships. And their second drilling ship, the Noble Discoverer, which had slipped anchor some months previously, is now the subject of a criminal investigation by the Coast Guard for violations of several laws around safety. And, you know, Shell has recently admitted to investors that both of its drilling rigs, the Kullock and the Noble Discoverer, are currently out of commission, one because of running aground and the other because it's not passing Coast Guard tests, which means right now they don't have a rig available for drilling in 2013 and they need two rigs. So while Shell are saying they're still planning to press ahead with Arctic drilling, at the moment they don't have the equipment to do so.
Right. Not looking good, I must say. I mean, if I was an investor, I would be very wary at this point. How significant is Arctic drilling to Shell's reserves portfolio currently? Presumably they just have a relatively small concession at this point to drill from the United States government.
In terms of how much reserves is in the Arctic lease areas that Shell are operating in, we don't know precisely. They haven't begun to drill down to be able to make an assessment. There are debates around precisely how much oil and gas is actually in the Arctic. There is only one study on that, and that itself is contested by various people. The wider issue, though, is relevant to reserves, and that is Shell, like all international oil companies, are now running out of places to go to find oil. We have a rise of national oil companies in Russia, in India. We have the nationalization of the oil industry in Venezuela. So international oil companies are being forced to what they call the frontiers. They're being forced to tar sands, to heavy fuel extractions like the Arctic. And so I think Shell view the Arctic as being really important to them in terms of keeping their reserve replacement ratios high. And that is without full certainty as to what is down there. the big question, of course, becomes not only how much oil is there, but how much is there and is commercially viable.
This, you mentioned this kind of general trend towards fossil fuel companies having to move into extreme, more and more extreme and high-risk energy sources, you know, whether it be the tar sands, you know, Arctic drilling, deep water drilling, hydraulic fracturing, which we're seeing right across the States, and, of course, you know, ongoing geopolitical risks. Are fossil fuel investments basically looking increasingly toxic? With that trend happening, are we likely to see more kind of deep water horizons and more hits for investments in these portfolios?
There's two major concerns with holding fossil fuel investments at the moment. The first, as you say, is sort of operational risk. Are we going to see significant spills? Hopefully not. However, to avoid spills in these really difficult frontier projects is going to be really, really expensive. And so to avoid the spill, you have to question whether it's going to be economical to do the project in the first place. So that's a big issue for investors in fossil fuel companies to look at. Are they investing their money in the right projects? Is it actually prohibitively expensive to do these sort of things? Should they be examining where they place their capital and whether they should be looking at to more renewable projects, for example? The second issue, if you hold fossil fuels, is what is the future of the fossil fuel industry in terms of climate change? Clearly, the burning of hydrocarbon fuels is a significant contributor to carbon emissions. Carbon emissions will create an unsustainable environment. If we have a 6-degree world, which is what most oil companies are working towards, let's be honest, you know, BP are on record that if the energy demand projections that they are working to come to pass, we will be on course for a 6-degree world. Just looking at fossil fuel companies on their own, how are they going to survive in a 6-degree world? You know, who's going to be buying fuel with all of the economic impacts that will flow from that? So how are all your other stocks going to perform in a world that's been ravaged by climate change? And I think that's an issue that investors really haven't got their heads around, that you may succeed and have a profitable fossil fuel investment, but it may come at the cost of greater economic stability and growth, and therefore, overall, how is your portfolio going to be performing?
Other actions investors should be taking, can they have an impact? And what does it mean for ordinary people that just might even have a pension? Is their pension at risk?
All of our pensions are generally invested, at least for some time in the lifespan of a pension, in UK companies that are listed on the stock exchange. Shell is, generally speaking, one of the largest holdings in every UK pension fund. So most of us are exposed to the performance of Shell and other oil companies, and that will impact on the pension that we can expect to receive when we retire. Their activities as an oil company will also, of course, impact on the type of world we retire into. So it's very important for individual pension savers to ensure that their pension provider is, first of all, looking at the bigger picture of climate change, the future of the fossil fuel industry, whether they, as investors, as owners of those companies, are having the right conversations with oil companies, whether they're asking about long-term strategy, about climate change mitigation. And on individual issues, operational risk, where if you had a sudden incident like deep water that you lose money in the short term, they need to be asking their pension provider whether they're having conversations with Shell about oil spill response, and if a spill was to occur, how the company would react to that. Or, you know, can the company simply explain what has gone wrong this summer, why it was so ill-prepared when it was declaring publicly extreme confidence in its Arctic drilling program for 2012. And many individuals might feel, well, how can I do that? And very simply, your pension provider, whether it's a workplace pension that you have with the trustees who act on your behalf, or you have a personal pension with an insurance company, they work for you and it's your money that they are investing in these companies. And you should contact the relevant point of contact and ask them those questions precisely. And Fair Pensions, you know, assists individual savers who want to ask those sorts of questions of their pension provider.
That was Louise Ruse of Fair Pensions. And if you're concerned about your pension or about investments held by your local council, faith group, trades union or other group, you can get in touch via their website at fairpensions.org.uk. And it's worth noting that in addition to the $40 billion that BP has had to allocate for costs so far in relation to the Deepwater Horizon disaster, this month the states of Louisiana and Mississippi have filed $34 billion claims in relation to long-term damage to the local ecology and the ongoing impacts on the health and livelihoods of the local communities. And in addition, there is a potential outstanding liability of a further $21 billion under the US Clean Water Act. To wrap up this programme, we return to James Marriott from Platform to explain how adding your voice to the debate matters and can make a difference. Thanks for listening to Climate Radio, and join us again in a month's time, and check out our website at climateradio.org, where you'll find all our programmes archived, along with useful links and references.
The most important thing one needs to remember, it seems to me, is that Shell is not interested in oil. BP is not interested in oil. They're interested in return and capital. They're interested in making profit. The only way you can make money out of the Arctic resources is by keeping your costs as low as possible and the income from the sale of oil and gas as high as possible. So they need to spend as little as possible to get it out of the ground and hope that the oil price is as high as possible when they start selling the stuff. One has to remember that they wouldn't, even if they got lucky, they wouldn't really be selling any oil and gas out from the Arctic for probably about a decade. But one thing they can do is to try and keep the costs down as low as possible. And that's what they're trying to do right now. Now, that might sound like a sensible way to run a household, but it's not a sensible way to run a drilling operation in the Arctic. And the reason why the Arctic stands to suffer from this inevitable environmental catastrophe that I was talking about is not only because there's lots of oil there and it's a bad idea to drill a hole in it, but also because the companies always try and do it cheaply. And the reason why Shell has had this litany of problems over the last year particularly is that again and again it's been shown that by trying to do it as cheaply possible you run into severe problems. Drilling rigs washed against the shore in a hurricane, you get ice flows coming and pushing you off course, you get fires on rigs, you get rigs dragging out anchors and so on and so forth. Now the interesting thing I think about that is that it's also where we, the public, can have an impact. We can make it more expensive for Shell. We are making it more expensive for Shell. Anybody who's protesting about this issue, raising it in the media, raising it with investors, raising it with lawyers, raising it with MPs, is making this thing more expensive for Shell. Why is it that the company had to go through a very, 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 very close inspection of their drilling rig in Alaska before it was allowed to get the licenses to go and to drill off Alaska? The reason is that there had been a big stink about this question in the media. You have to remember that the authority that is looking at whether or not the rig is fit to work offshore in Alaska is the very same authority that was trying to look at see whether or not it was fit for the Deepwater Horizon to work in the Gulf of Mexico. It's a different arm of the same body. We know what happened in the Deepwater Horizon. That body failed to look at it close enough and we had a disaster. Why are they taking a lot more effort to look at it more closely this time round? Because there was a strong civil society and political and indeed financial reaction to what happened in the Gulf of Mexico. The climate has changed, literally. And because people say, no, we don't want another Deepwater Horizon, and we don't want one in a place which we've learnt to love as children because we all watched David Attenborough and stuff like that, we know that that's precious, we know that that's important, and we don't want that to happen. Therefore, as a result of that, because of this public concern, public scrutiny, agencies such as the US coastal authorities that look at this rig take extra care to look at it. And as a result of that, it costs more for Shell to get it right, and their licenses were withheld for a longer period of time. Therefore, it costs them more money. Therefore, it's more difficult for them to drill the cheapness that they want to do. Therefore, it's more difficult for them to make profit out of the Arctic. And therefore, it's more unlikely that they will ever be able to do it. So my point is that we need to keep shouting about this. We need to take action about this. And we, the general public, both here and in the States and elsewhere in the world, can make that difference, and we damn well should do.